Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host. Patricia Kohlberg is our producer. Today's Memorial Day, so we'll focus on history, but not the history you read and hear about from conventional sources. We'll look back at World War II, not for its glory, hardships, nor foreign policy, but to see what we can learn from the role of government in the economy towards our own possibilities of a Green New Deal. We'll look back to that same era for a narrow slice of life, professional baseball, and the racism that underlay it. Is that simply a matter of the past? We'll resume our conversation with the author of Smelter Wars, about labor organizing here in the Northwest back then. And we'll put next week's People's Summit for Democracy and its Venezuelan delegation stopping here in Portland on their way to that gathering in historical context. Leading off, Bill Resnick talks with Marty Hart Landsberg about World War II lessons for a Green New Deal.
Hi, Marty Hart Landsberg. Welcome again to KBOO. Great to be with you, Bill. Marty Hart Landsberg taught economics, actually political economy. That's the Marxist-informed brand of economics at Lewis and Clark here in Portland. He's written 7 books on globalization. He also blogs. It's titled Reports from the Economic Front. It's mostly on the U.S. economy. It's for popular audiences and has won considerable readership. Over the last few years, Marty branched out into discussing climate change and recently published a profoundly important essay titled World War II Lessons for a Green New Deal. It's in the journal New Politics. We'll be discussing that article today. That article, as well as his other published works, can be found on his blog. So, Marty, tell us why you wrote that article and outline as much as possible its major themes, and then we can pursue some of them in some detail.
Great, Bill. Thanks for that introduction. Well, I think there's a lot for us to learn from a careful study of the World War II transformation experience. Not that we can duplicate it, but I think there are lessons that can help us achieve the kind of system change that we need to save the planet and ourselves. So let me try and give a little sense of why I think that's true. And when I say we here, I'm thinking of most of your KBOO listeners. I think we know that climate change is real and its consequences are deadly. And I also think most of us know that political and business leaders have just refused to make changes in the way our economies run in response to this climate change. So a lot of people have begun organizing to try and force changes in the system. And we can see all sorts of struggles. There are movements to electrify cars and buses. People are working for solar panels, installing wind turbines, recycling, retrofitting houses, changes in agriculture production. There are lots of things going on. But to this point, it seems to me that these efforts are rather separate, and they're focused on their own area of primary concern, and that we've largely failed to kind of join these efforts together in a way that can help us visualize what system change really means, and thus to convince ourselves and others that a better world is achievable. Now, some people have tried to kind of make these ties by saying, well, we're all doing these things under the banner of the Green New Deal. But to this point, the Green New Deal is really a list of desirable changes. There's no sense of a program or a process of change. And I don't think looking to the New Deal, although it's important in many ways, really helps us understand it. But this is where I think the World War II experience is important. The United States was faced with the need to transform its economy in about 3 years to fight and win in World War II. And they did that by a massive transformation in what the economy produced. For example, defense spending went from about 2% of GDP in 1940 to about 33% by 1943. And that year, about 46% of the economy was focused on spending on military and defense. So the federal government was really big. But it wasn't just that they spent a lot of money. It was, in fact, a transformation, because what they did was say there's some industries that are new that we have to build, like synthetic rubber. There are other industries we need to convert them from producing automobiles to producing tanks or engines for planes. We need new locations for new investment. We need to build housing. We need to train workers. We need to also suppress the production of all sorts of goods, like passenger goods, new refrigerators, all sorts of things. We need to figure out how to allocate stuff. In fact, over the period 40 to 44, non-military production actually fell by more than 10%. So what we had wasn't just, oh, let's just spend more money on the military, but let's convert the economy. And when you start to look at that and say, wow, they really did that. They really solved all these problems, not with a production miracle, because the growth of industrial production from 41 to 44 was no different from the growth of industrial production from 21 to 24. Yes, the economy grew, but the massive increase in military was tied to a massive restructuring of the economy, suppression of certain goods, allocating, rationing of other goods. So there's a way in which we can gain confidence that transformations can happen. The other thing that I think we can learn from is that the economy is interrelated. And so when they were planning these things, they had to say, well, what investment do we need in agriculture? What investment do we need in rail? What investment do we need in housing? What do we need for ships, planes? And not everything could be done. How do they all fit together? What things are synergistic? What things are contrary? We have all these groups working on changing different parts of the economy, but they're not really talking to each other. They're not really developing a coherent, shared vision of what a transformation would look like. The third lesson that I think is really important is that all these changes didn't happen because of private enterprise taking a leadership role or production for profit or market forces. They happened because the government evolved and created all sorts of new planning agencies that could decide how much spending should take place, could decide the location of new firms, could decide how training programs and movement of workers should take place, could decide how to allocate scarce raw materials and components, could decide how to tell which industries to suppress production and which to change the nature of their production. And when you study that, you realize you can't have a major transformation without an intensification of public power. And for us, the question is, well, what are the adequate ways that we would like to see strong government, more strong public redirection of our economy? How did they do it in World War II? How would we want to do it? The last thing that I think is important that an examination of World War II helps to show us is that these transformations are not just simple technical changes where, oh, we spend more money, we figure out how to allocate, we figure out what priorities, you know, where should steel go. Anytime you're transforming an economy, you are potentially shifting class power. And one of the strong things about World War II experience is that the capitalist class was very clear about its interests. In fact, it refused initially to engage in much investment, which is why the government had to take the leadership. And all through the war, it exercised whatever power it could through lots of very interesting mechanisms and ways to ensure that most of the investment would go to a few large companies, that those large companies would control, if not marginalize, small business, that whatever gains unions made would not be sustained after the end of the war, that the reconversion process would benefit them, not anyone else, and that people at the end of the war would say, it was American business that won the war, not the American government, not American workers. And so, in a sense, they were very clear from the very beginning what they wanted to achieve by the end of the war. And if we're really thinking about a Green New Deal, which isn't just try and reduce the use of fossil fuels, but to create a new economy, we have to be thinking now about how to prepare ourselves for the way capital might respond to the kinds of changes that we need to make. So for those four reasons, to conceive of what a transformation looks like, to understand the interconnections of all of our efforts because the economy is interconnected, to challenge us to think about what government planning can look like, should look like, and to prepare ourselves for the kind of class struggles that we can be certain will take place if we're able to make progress, I think there are lots of lessons and experiences that are valuable to us from studying the World War II experience.
Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick for KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, talking to Marty Hart Landsberg. Marty, I think you distinguished this period from the World War II period. Now we're in a position where the local level has to do a great number of things. In World War II, of course, the local level did maintain morale and superintended the war effort, collected tin cans. I used to, in fact, march into our butcher shop with a whole pail of tin cans that our family use. The local level was deeply involved, but not nearly as much as the local level has to be involved today. And you make that point in your work. Tell us about the local responsibilities.
Well, to start off, of course, the World War II experience cannot be just taken, you know, whole and recreated now. I mean, for one thing, two important things is the war provided a sense of common purpose that took a little bit of time, but after a year or two, by 1941, 42, people were fully on board with arming and then, in fact, fighting the war. And the second thing was that because of the Depression and then the New Deal, people were much more favorable to the role of government in carrying out activities and much more suspicious of business. And we have a situation today where, you know, climate deniers may not be in the majority, but people are confused. They know there's climate problems. Business is busily telling us, oh, they can solve all that with technology. Others are saying, oh, there really isn't a climate crisis. And so if we're going to be building commitments to really undertake a full system change, like I think we need to do, which is, again, echoing what you said, that the World War II experience says you can transform an economy. We don't have to do it quite as fast because we're not fighting a war. One of the challenges of the war conversion was that the military itself didn't know what technologies it was going to need. It was evolving as it went along. We have a bit of a clearer sense about what kinds of things we need to do as part of the transformation to transport people, to house people, to grow food, to generate energy. It's not quite as unknown for us. But we face these two problems, that one is people are not necessarily have confidence that there's either a need to or that a transformation can be made, and they don't have confidence in the state. They don't believe that states can really solve problems and direct things well. And of course, their disbelief in the state is because so many people who've been in positions of power have themselves sought to undermine the state and weaken the state. So how do we build up some of this confidence? We need to be thinking about system change, and we need to be integrating that in our work. But the local area is a place where we can experiment. We can do things like the Portland Clean Energy Fund, where we take money and give it to the community to begin to do things, where we can begin to work on our own transportation systems, when we can experiment by building greater solidarity between different groups that are trying to restructure how we live in an urban environment and feed those who live in an urban environment. So I think these are kinds of processes where we can convince people. For example, how is our education working? We know that there are teachers who are pursuing environmental curriculum. It would be wonderful if every neighborhood association met with their teachers and said, yes, teach more about climate change, and we want to talk to you about what you're doing. And every neighborhood group could go to the library and say, showcase environmental books and the nature of the crisis and the possibilities. And so people begin to get invested in this and begin to develop their capacities and their connections. But at some point, we have to recognize that a real transformation is going to require much bigger changes and changes that are connected across the country. And we have to be thinking in those terms and encouraging people to think in those terms that it's possible while we do and engage in local organizing to build up capacities and confidence.
Yeah. Seems to me, Marty, that a growing body of research is demonstrating that the placement of our energy generation should be near the point of use, that is, very near the small cities and the big cities, such that you don't lose energy and transmission and that you don't need a huge, expensive, continent-spanning grid of the kind that the investor-owned utilities are seeking money from the government for. It's a huge boondoggle. And, in fact, it's very unreliable. My line is the big grid is only as reliable as the most vulnerable pylon. Well, they're out of service a lot, and in fact, it's getting worse and worse. Cities can, in fact, build reliable systems, especially when they're confederated over the region. And the research shows that it's the cheapest form of energy. We have all the technologies we need, and we have all the land, the ruined lands we need, the rooftops are a prime source. That has to be done at the local level. Partly identifying where we're going to put generation facilities has to be done at the local level, and it can be done in a radically democratic way. People can be involved in thinking about and making the decisions about the kind of society they want to live in, as to transport, as to food distribution, as to how we manage water resources. Those become important issues, even at the local level. I'm sure you agree, but...
Well, I mean, I appreciate your local focus.
You get the last word.
I want to take it back up a second because, you know, you're focusing on energy, yes, and you're focusing on the ways to use, you know, rooftops and things, but we have a housing emergency in the country, and a lot of it has to do with the collapse of the federal housing program. We have a transportation situation where we need, you know, to develop new forms of transportation, including rail. There are a whole lot of issues that all come together to make a different way of living. And I'm not against local activism and local experimentation. But again, if we're really saying that what we're trying to do with a Green New Deal or envision a different world, it's multi-pronged and multi-connected. And a lot of this stuff requires money, and it also requires suppressing existing activities. And if you're going to raise the price of oil, you're going to hurt the airline industry. You're going to hurt the tourism industry as it's currently constructed. How do we move people? How do we decide what those skills should be used for? How do we decide where people should be living and working? How do we decide how to reformat and restructure many of the activities? And if we can't do everything, what goods should be rationed? How do we allocate them? A lot of these things are beyond the ability of local communities and local governments to do. And appropriately, it needs to be part of a broader national plan. And so I'm not saying that the World War II experience can teach us everything, but the question of how you decide, okay, we are going to raise the price of oil really high to move people away from using fossil fuels. We have to be prepared to know. We can't just say, oh, we want a just transition. What does that literally mean? What lessons can we learn from World War II that show how governments can actually engage in planning, how they can successfully say, this is the shutdown. These are the skills you have. These are what we want you to do. In fact, the UAW was saying when the buildup was taking place, auto industry, you can produce for the war effort. And here's our plan. You should unify all the different auto plants and create committees of workers and committees of technicians and committees of managers and use all these plants as one big production process. And we want to be involved in helping to do that. And the auto industry said, no, can't do that, won't do that. The war happened. Finally, the government said, no more cars. And business did all that, just what I'm saying. They shared machine tools, but they didn't allow worker involvement so that the production processes remained top down and workers remained with very little authority. But envisioning how to restructure all of our industries. It's not just about energy. It's not just about housing. It's about the relationship of all these things. And we are so far into this notion of market economy and individuals and separation that we've lost a sense of how do we put this all together? And I'm not saying that the answers are in World War II, but when you study that experience, it helps you begin to very concretely say, here's a problem. How did they do it? How should we do it? How should our vision be different? How might it have to be different? Our aims are different. So it's a matter, to me, of fighting as hard as we can on all the fronts that you're mentioning, but at the same time, trying to come together as a movement that really is committed and understands that without big system change, suppressing the production of certain goods and services that are no longer needed and despoiling the environment and not helpful to us, and get those resources to be doing something else. Those things can't just happen simply and only locally. We have to build up to that process. But if we don't have the process in mind, if we're not challenging ourselves to say, what does a transformation look like? What are the public skills that we need? What are the ways in which capital will always seek to control it and ensure that whatever gains are modest? Those are things that we need to be confronting, and we need historical examples that can help us do that. And the World War II situation is an ideal one for posing those kinds of challenges.
Yeah, Marty, I completely agree. I thought it sort of goes without saying the federal government has to fund it. The federal government has, in fact, a great number of things that must be done. including creating for all localities in this country, creating a set of options for how they can meet the goals. And the set of options wouldn't include nuclear power.
Right.
The set of options would certainly not include contracting out to the investor-owned utilities, the responsibility for building out clean energy, and the federal government would have to have the role of superintending the development of not just the energy system, but the transport system, the agricultural changes towards regenerative agriculture, and which is the only way to sequester carbon, forest health too. Yes, the federal government has this huge role, but Marty, take a last word, but brief, and we have to sign off. But thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you, Bill. For people who want to get into more of the specifics of how I see the World War II experience and the particular lessons, let me encourage them to read that article that you mentioned, Bill, and to see some of the other things on the blog. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these big questions with you.
The blog is Reports from the Economic Front. Thanks a lot, Marty.
Thanks, Bill.
That was Bill Resnick with Marty Hart Landsberg. Now, Luisa Martinez and Leo Flores alert us to next Monday's Tabor Space event with a visiting delegation of Venezuelan women on their way to a People's Summit for Democracy. More info on that event on our Old Mole website.
Hey, everybody. This is Luisa, and today I have the opportunity to interview Leo Flores of Code Pink. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Luisa.
Leo Flores is a Latin American campaign coordinator with Code Pink. He holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of Maryland, and he proudly dropped out of a master's program at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy to work as an analyst on U.S.-Venezuela relations. Leo was born in Venezuela and maintains close ties to social movements that have transformed the country over the past 20 years. Leo, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So can you tell me, you're Venezuelan, so can you tell me a little bit about your background and why you maintain close ties to your home country?
Sure. So I was born in Venezuela, but my family moved to the U.S. when I was really young, actually. I was about 1.5, and they moved to the D.C. area. And back then in the 80s, it was still kind of inexpensive to travel to Venezuela, so we would go back maybe every summer, every other summer. And one of the things that would always catch my eye was just the inequality, right? The economic inequality, because you land in the airport and between going to the airport and going to Caracas, you drive and you see on the hills, people basically living in tin shacks. And then you arrive in Caracas and it's a city where there's, you know, skyscrapers and mansions and like fancy cars. And as a kid, this really shocked me because here where I live in DC, the inequality is a little bit more hidden, right? You have to like travel a little further to see, you know, I grew up in kind of a middle-class neighborhood and kind of poverty was hidden. And so I think that kind of led me to become a socialist in part, because as soon as I started reading about socialism, I was like, oh, well, this makes sense to me. This is kind of what I've been experiencing in terms of, you know, that pain you feel when you see these kind of inequalities. And then in 1998, Hugo Chavez won the elections, and I wasn't quite sure really who he was, and I wasn't kind of super convinced until I saw the constitution that Venezuelans drafted themselves in 1999, and they voted on in a referendum. And they approved it, and it was incredibly progressive. And then I thought, oh, wow, something really interesting is going on here. And it's something that I'm not really too, you know, I wasn't really kind of a part of at the time. And so I got more curious and did more research. And then by the time the coup attempt in 2002 came along, that totally convinced me, because there you had a coup where basically the armed forces and the government elite overthrew the government for 48 hours, but the people rose up and reverted the coup. They reversed it within the period of one weekend. And it was just so inspiring to see, you know, the mass mobilization of people saying, we want our president back, we want our democracy back. This is the path we've chosen, and we were insisting on it. And since then, you know, I was completely converted, and I made it kind of my mission to get involved in a way. And so I got involved mostly through working at the the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. And it was through the Venezuelan embassy that I got to make a lot of contacts with social movements, with communes, with feminist organizations and leaders. And those ties have kind of, you know, helped me over the years, not just to understand what's going on in Venezuela, but they've inspired me to kind of keep up the anti-imperialist fight here in the U.S.
So taking a turn in the other direction, but still timely, the OAS, they're having the Summit of the Americas that's taking place June 6th through 10th in Los Angeles in the United States. If you'll bear with me, I'm actually going to read from the State Department website, their definition of what the Summit of the Americas is. And then I'd like you to define it as a Latin American who's organizing not just against the legal sanctions, but also U.S. imperialism at large. So, and again, forgive me, the State Department says only the Summit of the Americas brings together leaders from the countries of North, South, and Central America and the Caribbean. The summit and its stakeholder forums promote cooperation towards region-wide inclusive economic growth and prosperity based on our shared respect for democracy, fundamental freedoms, the dignity of labor, and free enterprise. So can you tell me what the OAS, Summit of the Americas, actually is?
Yeah, so the OAS, the Organization of American States, the really the easiest way to understand what it is, it's a tool for the State Department, for the U.S. government, to influence Latin America and the Caribbean. And since 1994, they've had these massive summits where they invite supposedly every country in the Americas, except, of course, since 94 until I think it was 2015, Cuba was excluded. So right off the bat, you know, they talk about, you know, the largest gathering of hemispheric leaders. That's not even true anymore, because there's another organization in the region called CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, and they also have massive summits. And the only countries that aren't really invited are the United States and Canada. So that's two countries missing. But from the Summit of the Americas this time around, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela are not invited. So three countries missing. So this summit is actually smaller than the CELAC summits that we generally have. And the thing about the Summit of the Americas is that it's basically a showcase for the United States to, you know, propose policies for the next 5 years or so, 3 to 5 years, and to showcase for basically pliant governments that are, you know, in the thrall of the United States to show what they've been doing in order to kind of converge policy-wise with the United States. And it's often been a disaster. So for example, in 2018, the theme of the Summit of the Americas was corruption. And yet it was held in Peru. And 3 weeks before it was held, the Peruvian president was basically, he was taken out of office because of corruption issues, right? And so there was a massive corruption scandal right before this huge anti-corruption summit. This time around, they're talking about the Summit of the Americas in LA being about democracy and about freedom. And yet they're excluding these three countries, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And well, on the other hand, they're inviting their, you know, countries like Colombia, which is very clearly a narco dictatorship, Brazil, which is sliding into a dictatorship as well with Bolsonaro, and you know, similar countries in the region that have a lot of democratic problems, including the United States itself, of course. So really what the Summit of the Americas represents for many of us in the global South, particularly in Latin America and the Caribbean, is it's an example of the utmost hypocrisy of the United States. It's a showcase really for the United States to show how false they are when it comes to things like human rights and democracy.
Okay, and then can you tell us what the counter to that is, what the People's Summit is?
Yeah, so since 2002 in Quebec, when they held the Summit of the Americas, in 2002, there was a mass protest against the Summit of the Americas. And that became institutionalized. So in 2005, when it was in Argentina, there was the first official counter summit. And at that counter summit, Hugo Chavez spoke and he declared the free trade agreement of the Americas to be completely dead. And so at that point, the counter summit became more important than the summit itself, because that's where the news was breaking. This time around, there's a counter summit. It's called the People's Summit for Democracy. The website is peoplesummit2022.org. It's being held in LA from June 8th through 10th. And it's basically 3 days of art and music, speakers, debates, workshops, panel discussions, protests, all of which are meant really to uplift the voices of the people and imagine a new world that really puts democracy first.
Okay. And then we've been, us as individuals, we've been working on a project together along with a team of other folks, the Venezuelan Feminist Tour. The tour is comprised of three women from Venezuela who will be visiting seven Democratic Socialists of America chapters across the U.S. to discuss the impact of illegal U.S. sanctions, but from a feminist perspective. Right. You can visit the Old Mole website with that links to the DSA International Committee landing page for more information, or visit the DSA International Committee or Code Pink Twitter accounts. There's emerging research from by organizations, independent human rights organizations, but even organizations like the UN, which is dominated by U.S. power, right? We see this when it comes to votes regarding Palestine, for instance. They've demonstrated, even the UN has demonstrated, how women and children are disproportionately, they bear the brunt of illegal sanctions. So can you please talk about the women who will be visiting us, the three women, but then also some of the research that's been done on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So the three women, and I'm really excited that they're coming on this tour. They're all, you know, very connected to social movements and political movements in the country. One of them is named Monica. She's an arts administrator. She's Afro-Venezuelan. She manages this kind of Afro-Venezuelan drum group that is beyond being a band. They also provide workshops and education, and it's a way to keep Afro-Venezuelan musical traditions alive. And so, you know, very excited about her. She's a professor at the National Experimental Arts University in Caracas. The second person coming is, her name is Angie. She's Wayuu. Wayuu is one of the biggest indigenous nations in Venezuela. They're kind of on the western part of Venezuela, on the border with Colombia. The Wayuu territory actually encompasses both parts of Colombia and Venezuela. She is, you know, an indigenous rights activist and a women's rights activist as well. She worked on reproductive rights. She's part of various social movements, and she comes from like a long line of indigenous Wayuu activists. In fact, her brother is, I think, the first Wayuu filmmaker in Venezuela, and her mother was one of the people who was, you know, helped shape indigenous policy in the country. And thirdly, we have Yolimar, last but not least. Yolimar is an industrial engineer. She's worked at the state-owned oil company, PDVSA. She's also worked at Petrocaribe. But more importantly, she's worked as a teacher for Mision Sucre. So Venezuela over the last 20 some years has these things called social missions, which have been really provided education and health and other social needs to underserved populations. And Mision Sucre was a way to get, you know, adults free higher education. We're talking about adults who previously might not even have graduated high school and were denied educational opportunities for their whole life. But then through this mission, they got more access to education. So that's what I'm really looking forward to listening to from Yolimar. And they're not all going to talk about how these sanctions have primarily hurt women and children in the country. I mean, if we look at the statistics, they're really kind of jaw-dropping, right? According to a former UN Special Rapporteur, Alfred de Zayas, 100,000 people died from the sanctions alone between 2017 and 2020. That's building off research from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a think tank in DC, that found that 40,000 people died in the first year alone. So that number has probably gone a lot higher. And let me just end this part by reading this quote from Alina Duhan, who's the current UN Special Rapporteur on basically sanctions. She wrote this after a fact-finding mission to Venezuela. She wrote, "The economic blockade of Venezuela and the freezing of central bank assets have a devastating effect on the whole population of Venezuela, especially those in extreme poverty, women, children, medical workers, people with disabilities or life-threatening or chronic diseases, and the indigenous population." And just to give like one little stat, you know, in 2015, the top children's hospital in Venezuela was performing 5 heart surgeries per day. By 2020, because of the sanctions, and because of how the sanctions destroyed the economy, affecting investment into the healthcare sector, and preventing medical equipment and other goods from entering the country, that same hospital was down to 120 surgeries per year. So less than 1 a day, whereas before it was 5 a day. So that's, and it's really been the healthcare sector that's been hit the hardest, and of course, the economy. And when the economy gets hit, it's women who bear the brunt of it.
You know, it's always difficult when we talk about illegal sanctions against these countries, because we never want to paint Venezuelans, Cubans, Nicaraguans, Iranians, whoever, as just victims, right? And so, for instance, so talking about resistance, one positive development as a result of illegal sanctions that passed under Trump has been food sovereignty for Venezuelans, right? So prior to the blockade, Venezuela imported most of its food. And now, because of the food scarcity that blockade caused, Venezuelans have developed farming programs, communes, working with communes in cooperation with private sector, to the point where the majority of food in Venezuela is produced locally. So can you give us just a couple examples of the forms of Venezuelan resistance to the U.S. government?
Yeah, and let's make it clear that the sanctions were designed to suffocate the Venezuelan people to the point that they would rise up and overthrow their own government. But that hasn't happened. And why hasn't it happened? Because it's the people themselves who are organizing to be able to survive, right? And let me give you a couple of examples. And when we're talking about the issue of food sovereignty, there's been a couple of very important programs. One is kind of a people's initiative. It's called Plan Pueblo a Pueblo, the people-to-people plan. And then through that, you had consumers, particularly those in cities, in particularly poorer neighborhoods, they organized together, they contacted their counterparts in rural Venezuela, the people who are growing the food, and they came up with a scheme, basically, I don't know, call it like a CSA on a much larger scale, right? Where they would directly purchase from the producers, ensuring the producers have a market and have a kind of income before the harvest. And then they would get the food directly, cutting out any sort of brokers or middlemen who might jack up the prices because, you know, again, another of the impacts of sanctions is hyperinflation. A similar program, but this one led by the government, is called CLAP, which are local committees for supply and production. Through this CLAP food program, 7 million families get this box of food and other necessities at least once a month. And that has been incredibly, you know, useful and life-saving in terms of being able to ensure that Venezuelans don't starve and aren't undernourished. And at the same time, you know, the undernourishment level has gone up quite a bit, but without these sorts of programs, the situation would be significantly worse. And there's been all sorts of kind of ingenuity going on. So for example, there's another group called the Productive Workers Army. And these are, you know, women and men who are technicians or laborers in kind of manufacturing centers. And what they do is they get together kind of on the weekends or they take time off and they go to state-owned companies, and they fix them. Because one of the problems with the sanctions, again, is the lack of being able to import equipment, not just because of lack of money, but because sometimes banks block those transactions. I'm talking about regular transactions for, you know, manufacturing, you know, I don't know, tuna fish or whatever, right? And so they go to these factories that were, many of them were worker controlled, and then they teach the workers how to kind of repair the machines themselves without having to rely on outside goods coming in. So we have all sorts of really innovative programs that are going on. Urban agriculture has really skyrocketed in the past 5 to 10 years. And this is what's really led, you know, the country to be able to survive, and not just survive. It seems like the bottom, you know, Venezuela hit bottom maybe last year, year and a half ago, because now everything indicates that the economy is starting to recover. Of course, it will never fully recover until the sanctions are lifted, just like Cuba, despite how amazing their, you know, biotech, biohealth sector is, you know, their economy is never going to be normal until the blockade is lifted. And it's the same for Venezuela, same for every sanctioned country in the world, really.
Well, we can end the segment on more good news. The Venezuelan Feminist Tour is actually visiting Portland. So they will be with us June 6th at 6 p.m. at Taper Space in Portland, Oregon. Please wear your mask because masks are required. Leo, thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks, Luisa, with Leo Flores. Poetry and baseball. Baseball and poetry. You may have heard the poems and songs, Casey at the Bat, for instance, or Take Me Out to the Ball Game, the songs and poetry that glorify professional sports and suggest that rooting for paid athletes is part of our identity, part of what defines us as Americans or as members of a community. Casey at the Bat became part of an explicit patriotic effort to claim baseball as a U.S. invention, having nothing to do, of course, with a remarkably similar English game that had been played for centuries. Take Me Out to the Ball Game dates from that same era when sports were consciously used to integrate immigrants into American culture and what were projected as American values. But the song became especially popular in the years right after World War II, a lighthearted reminder of what we all supposedly had in common during a time of huge labor unrest, of sending women back from our workplaces to their kitchens and babies, of welcoming black soldiers who had fought for freedom abroad back to their segregated homes. In a moment, we'll hear Old Mole Matt Witt's poem about baseball. Instead of using sports to gloss over class, racial, and gender injustices, to pretend we're somehow above them and all united around some spectator nationalism, Matt's poem reminds us that sports are part and parcel of our issues, our divisions, our struggles. There were big celebrations this spring of the 75th anniversary of Major League racial integration, of allowing African-American Jackie Robinson to play on the same field as white players. As the underlying racism passed from baseball after those many years? You might have noticed the skirmish that interrupted a Yankees-White Sox game just a couple of weeks ago, when a white player persisted in taunting a black player, repeatedly calling him, "Jackie, Jackie." After Robinson, another black player, Roy Campanella, whom Matt met as a youngster, joined the Los Angeles Dodgers. As Matt writes, Campy was the National League's most valuable player three times, only to have his career cut short by a car accident that confined him to a wheelchair. The end of the ban on black players followed 14 years of protests led by civil rights groups and labor unions that put pressure on the Dodgers and other teams. Jackie Robinson had served as an army officer in World War II and had been court-martialed for refusing to sit at the back of a military bus. Roy Campanella had been invited to a tryout with the Pittsburgh Pirates, but refused to take part when the team made it clear that the tryout was just a PR exercise and they had no intention of actually hiring any black player. Facts like these are left out of most media accounts and Hollywood movies. The story they tell is that an enlightened Dodgers general manager just happened to come up with the idea of hiring Robinson and Campanella, and that these black players were so naive that they had to be lectured by their white boss about how to handle the hostility they would face. Those are some words of introduction that Matt wrote to his poem. We'll post a photo of 7-year-old Matt Witt with Roy Campanella on the Old Mole website. Here's Matt with his poem, Campy.
How simple the world seemed when I was 7 years old and met Roy Campanella, the greatest catcher of all time. And he asked me about the team I was on and what position I liked to play, and told me to keep practicing, and didn't tell me that when he was my age, he couldn't dream about playing in the major leagues, or about the years of protests it took to change that, or how when black men came home from World War II, many could no longer accept playing in separate leagues, or sitting in separate seats, or being called boy, or much worse. How simple the world seemed. But later, much later, when I read the history books that said that Jackie Robinson and Campy got to play because Branch Rickey, the Dodgers' white general manager, had the courage to finally see the light, and that he trained them to behave themselves so they wouldn't cause problems for the team. By then, I was old enough to know that there was more to that story.
Thanks to Matt Witt for his poem and its background. Now we turn to the second part of a conversation I had with Ron Verjou, author of Smelter Wars, a new book about the work life and union organizing at the smelter complex in Trail, British Columbia, just across the Canadian border. I introduced part one of our conversation by raising questions about the potential role of unions in social transformation. We began at a very basic level by talking about the work life at the smelter, the kind of work we do, how it structures our lives and relationships with other workers, has consequences for how we see the world and its possibilities. It has consequences for our ability and willingness to engage in activism, and for the kind of activism we embrace. In that earlier conversation, Ron talked also about the early efforts at worker organizing at the smelter, the various schemes the company adopted to counteract those efforts, and the coming together of the Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Union under Communist Party leadership. You can listen to that part of our conversation by going to the Old Mole Archives on kboo.fm for April 25th of this year. That left us with some big questions. First of all, on the significance of Communist Party leadership in the Union beyond those cultural activities. Was the leadership different from the leadership of other unions? Did they have a different vision for what unions could be? For instance, more rank and file controlled? Were they more vulnerable to the anti-communism that took so much post-World War II political space in the U.S.? And how did that McCarthyism play out in Canada? What about a non-communist left? What dilemmas did it face in working within a communist-led union? And then there are the questions that arise in looking at any unions of that era, and that still have resonance today. For instance, how they responded to the influx of women into the unionized workforce. Here is part two with Ron Verjou.
What they had in Trail was a fairly strong kind of cadre of communist members. And they were, for the most part, local communists. They weren't beholden necessarily to a party leadership in Vancouver or Toronto, where there were main leadership pockets. They knew their marks to a large extent. That was something that, I mean, they were talking about four or five people at the start, right, who actually led the drive. And Slim was the guy at the head of it, Slim Evans. But they came to it as local communists. They came to it as people who had the ideology down, but knew that that wouldn't fly locally particularly. Also, they knew they were being confronted with all sorts of, as I said earlier, anti-communist views. So they were finding ways to be trade unionists, to use their ideological underpinnings to actually try to get a union in there for starters, which was a 6-year struggle, and then to hold it together when a lot of other enemies came along to try and undo it. So they couldn't really be ideological in the sense that they would promote communist policies directly, but they did, and you know from the Mine Mill Constitution, they did have good principled stands on many things. Now, you know, on race, on gender, and on even the environment. It's Local 480, by the way, the Mine Mill, Local and Trail. Local 480 took some good stands on that. But, you know, we'll come to the chapter on women workers and on, you know, women generally. They weren't too good stands. They were breadwinner people. They believed that a male breadwinner's social system was workable and they wanted to stick with it. So, you know, where you might have had communist policy that suggested otherwise, not all of it, but some of it, that was kind of being taken to task by the local union, not particularly feminist oriented.
See if I can kind of summarize from reading the book. Basically, you treat them as good, strong, militant unionists, that's what the leadership consisted in, focusing heavily on bread and butter issues, with, as you've just said, some interesting policy kinds of positions. Our listeners, of course, know about McCarthyism in the US and some of the consequences even for unions in the US that were led by Communist Party members or affiliates. How'd that play out in Canada?
Well, the book does talk about Canadian McCarthyism. It seems like an oddball thing to call it, but in fact, it came across the border in its various ways. And the government of the day, the Laurier government, actually embraced some of the McCarthy policies to try and get rid of the Reds and the Reds under every bed kind of policy. And they were determined to go after the trade union movement in that respect, both with the federal and provincial governments, but also with other institutions within society at that time. So you get this, this kind of odd kind of McCarthyism, and it's being picked up at the border, because we're 10 miles from the border in Trail. So they're getting a lot of feedback from Spokane, which is the largest nearby center. And this is all kind of percolating. You're getting a lot of the activities that are being, the union activities that are, you know, sort of wobbly-like or, you know, kind of violent activities are being talked about in the local press and condemned in the local press. This is how they're portraying unionism, right? So communists get basically called violent and basically they're leading the revolution, they think, but they're leading right down a path which is going to get them in a lot of trouble and locally. These guys were, the ones I'm talking about in the book were stalwart lefties. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they had to do, and they were gutsy. They were willing to take some chances. Guys like Jack Scott, you'll read about, who was a strong left winger, a veteran of the World War, a decorated veteran of World War II, came into Trail, and he was not a guy who was a wallflower. He wasn't going to sit back. He knew he was a communist, when later it became a Trotskyist, and he basically said, we're going to do something in this town to make sure it's a worker-friendly town as much as possible. So that's a little bit of the answer. I'm hesitant to move further into the 50s when you've got McCarthyism really hitting pretty hard, but there are some interesting cross-border issues there. The book talks about two of them. One was the removal of Paul, a famous opera singer, Paul Robeson's passport when he went to sing in Vancouver at a Mine Milk convention and was told by the Secretary of State in the U.S. that he couldn't do that, that he was banned from traveling. The Mine Mill Union basically went to bat for him. And that resulted in four pretty memorable border conferences. They're called the Peace Arch Concerts. And concerts, not conferences. And Robeson sang for 4 years in the early 50s each year as his way of connecting with the Canadian workforce and Mine Mill members in British Columbia. Again, there's a half a chapter on that, so people might find that interesting as an American connection. And, you know, Paul was an incredible supporter of Mine Mill. The other event that was really fascinating for me was the showing of the film Salt of the Earth in Trail, in that area, back in 54, because that was basically... How to summarize this, Norm? I mean, basically, this was a Hollywood 10 movie. The people who were ostracized from Hollywood for being communists made a film about a strike in the early 50s in a little town in New Mexico. And this it's one of the incredible parts of the strike, from my point of view, was that they tackled a big zinc corporation and they won. They said, this is not on the way you're treating us here. And one of the really mainstays of it was that the women of the town basically took on the role of pickets, and they picketed the company, and they kept the picket line alive and protected the picket line all during the strike. And that was a big part of the film, Salt of the Earth, was just showing how that developed and showing the role of women and the consequent role of men having to do the diapers and get the laundry out and do some of the homework because they were banned from the picket line. So just an incredible story of a community that rose up and said, the company's not going to beat us. I think it was inspiration for the Trail people and for the people who supported Local 480 to see this film. And this local union had the guts to show it. It was a banned film, and they brought it into Canada and brought it into this little area of British Columbia and showed it to the people there and got a full house five times. So it was pretty neat.
We're talking about some of the implications of having Communist Party leadership, militant leadership in the Mine Mill Union. There are a lot of associated questions that I want to come back to, actually. But earlier you talked about the response to that to communist leadership in the press, by the company, within the church. A big area we haven't addressed yet is other unions and the response being a raid by another union, actually my old union, the steelworkers.
And mine.
Yeah, and yours. And it was yours because, well, by the time you were working in the smelter, the steelworkers had basically taken over. But Mine Mill was able to resist until they ended up merging with the steelworkers. So talk a little bit about that process. What does the raid look like? And let's actually hold off on the question of how Mine Mill resisted. I want to come back to that and talk about it more directly. Because sure. They were successful in resisting in some important respects.
Yes.
So what does a raid look like?
Well, in this case, as you say, the steelworkers were more or less sanctioned by the CIO to take over Mine Mill locals. Now, these guys are already organized into a union. It's a member union of an affiliate of the CIO. But at that point, because the union movement, as it's represented by the CIO, decided that communists were bad and needed to be taken out, Steele was given the mandate to do that. They went ahead with passion. It's a big union at the time. There are a million people, members of that union, and it's got a huge bankroll. So it can go into a town like Trail with, maybe 12,000 people at the time, 5,000 workers. And it can start to work its way in and say, you don't need this mine mill local union anymore. You need us. So I'm trying to sort of skirt around what actually happened, but essentially they set up a system of radio advertisements. There was a local radio station there, by the way, CJAT. They bought press time. They published big full page ads. So it became a kind of war of words between the mine mill people and the steelworker people. And they were both, because at this point, the old company union had actually been banned. The law in British Columbia had banned company unions, but it didn't ban independent Canadian unions. And this was kind of the early days of the Canadian nationalist fight for unions to be Canadian, not just international, as the American unions were called. So this kind of was the battleground. The battle zone was steel coming in and basically making a lot of noise and the mine mill guys fighting back. And again, it was a war of ads, a war of radio speeches, a war of meetings and big conferences to just basically try to give the respective sides of the arguments. And the mine mill side was usually to try and say that whether we have communist leaders or not is not the issue. Are we doing a good job? Are we negotiating good agreements? You know, are we taking the stands that we should take as a workforce and trail against the company when the company does the wrong thing? So that, to me, was the beginnings of the beginnings of the raid, because what happened was that the local got taken over by a guy who once worked for a mine mill, who then decided he was an anti-communist, and he ran for president of Local 480 and won in 1947, the very year that they passed the infamous Taft-Hartley Act in the States. So again, which had some crossover effects on Canada. He basically then led a movement to remove mine mill from trail and from the smelter workforce. That's when the steelworkers stepped in.
This is Norm Diamond. I've been talking with Ron Verjou, author of Smelter Wars. That was part two of our conversation. We'll resume and have part three the next time we do an episode of Another World is Possible. And that is our program for today. I'd like to thank today's contributors, Old Mole's Bill Resnick, Luisa Martinez, Matt Witt, Patricia Kohlberg, and John Nelson, and guests Marty Hart-Landsberg and Leo Flores. A big thank you to KBOO's staff, who keep things running remarkably smoothly with limited resources and under difficult conditions. The Old Mole Variety Hour is on every Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Till next week, again, this is Norm Diamond. Stay safe and stay active.